This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. North Carolina has its own so-called hidden figure to claim. Hidden Figures is the title of the book and movie that tells the story of African-American women in NASA in the 1960s who worked as human computers and helped to open outer space to astronauts.
You're a computer at NASA. You let women handle that sort of...
Yes, it's an uphill battle.
Yes, they let women do some things at NASA, Mr. Johnson. And it's not because we wear skirts. It's because we wear glasses.
And that's from the movie Hidden Figures from the 2017 film. Christine Darden was born in Monroe, North Carolina, started as a human computer at NASA in 1967, had a 40-year career there, and actually helped to develop a sonic boom research program. She and two of her NASA peers were recently nominated for a Congressional Gold Medal for their contributions to space exploration. And Christine Darden joins us now. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you very much.
Good to have you here. I want to talk all about your career at NASA, but first talk about growing up in Monroe, North Carolina. Your mom was a school teacher, right?
Yes, she was.
You a pretty good student, were you?
Yes, I did. I did fine.
You did very well. In fact, you finished high school, I think, at the age of 15. Am I right?
I did. I started early. I did every year, but I did start early, so I finished at 15.
So talk about going to school, because there were questions about whether you should move ahead, skip a couple of grades. Talk about that and how that affected your education.
Well, I don't know that there was ever a question about skipping, but since I started early, I think my mother told me much later that if she had to do it over again, she would not let me be early, more because of the social problems that I had being 2 years younger than all of my classmates. And I would be bothering her to want to go to this dance or go here or there where they were going, and she didn't think I should go.
It's enough trouble trying to raise a teenager, but when you're 2 years younger than the rest of them, that's even tougher. When did you realize you were interested in math?
Well, I took geometry when I went to school in Asheville, North Carolina, and I absolutely fell in love with that class. I did very well. I enjoyed how the teacher taught the class and everything, and I think it was then that I realized that I wanted to major in mathematics, and I liked the physical side of the sciences rather than the biological side.
Talk about this, because this would have been the late 1950s, right? And we are, you know, is that right?
That's true. I finished high school in 58.
So
when I took the geometry class, it would have been 56, 57.
What about, did you find that women were, or girls at that time in high school, were being encouraged or discouraged about pursuing math in those years?
Well, I don't remember hearing a lot about it, but I was in an all-girls school. All my teachers were female. So they would not discourage me, I don't think. I was encouraged. And even on the student day when we would teach certain classes, I taught the geometry class. I dressed like the teacher dressed. I absolutely loved that class.
Well, when did you decide that you wanted to pursue math in college?
It was that year, I believe. And then when I went off to college after I graduated, I went to major in math. But that's when my father called me and said, well, I'm not sure that there are many jobs for an African-American mathematician in 1958. And I think you should get a teacher certificate so you can get a job when you graduate.
And did you?
And I did. I ultimately decided to do what he said, but I also decided to take all of my electives through college. And there would have been about seven or eight of them. I would take all of them in higher mathematics classes that were required for a mathematician, but not required for a high school math teacher. And so I sort of did both things.
And you started taking free in-service classes in higher math as well, and then got a job at Virginia State College in Petersburg, Virginia, right? Tell us more about that.
I did. I continued after I was out teaching, and my teacher at Virginia State was the head of the math department. And when I asked him about a job, when I thought we were going to be moving there, he put me on to the head of the physics department, who was looking for a research assistant in aerosol physics. And we went and talked to him that night, and I got the job that night.
It's interesting. So that very early, and again, we're talking about the late 50s, early 60s here, it sounds like you didn't run into much in the way of discrimination, racial or gender discrimination, at least at this point, or did you?
I don't think I did. I don't think my parents ever questioned me about what I liked to do. I was sort of a tomboy growing up. I helped my dad change tires on cars. I helped him cut the grass. I, fixed my bicycle with a coat hanger and things like that. So I guess I always had the attitude, if I'm physically not strong enough to do a job, you can say I female can't do it. But if that's not the issue, then don't tell me what I cannot do because I'm a female.
Well, you and your dad and your mom may have had that attitude, but there was a big wide world out there that wasn't thinking the same way, and those were the people who held those jobs. So and those fellowships.
Well, that's true, but I didn't run into any problems with them. And even Dr. Hodkinson, the physics professor, after I had worked with him for 1 year, he went over to Europe during the summer to sail, and he got killed in a boating accident. Mm-hmm. And I had friends who had to drop out of school or change majors because they didn't have anybody to guide their research. There was a chemistry professor there who knew light scattering. He said, I will step in and become your sponsor and help you with your research.
Wow.
So that worked out, too.
You also carried something with you called P to the fourth power. Tell us more about that.
Yes. When my dad called about becoming a teacher because I, needed to get a job, I had already kind of convinced myself I really wanted to be a mathematician. And in part of convincing myself of that, I had thought about what I needed. And, of course, when I got to Hampton and students coming from the larger school systems had had trigonometry and calculus and things like that, I had had none of that. So I knew that I needed to take a lot of mathematics if I was going to be a mathematician. And I would not get all of that mathematics with the teacher high school curriculum. And so I believed that having thought about that P to the fourth power, which was perceive of myself in the job I want, plan what it is you have to do or what experiences you need to get to that job, prepare yourself, and that's working your plan, and fourth is persist, because you will run into problems. Well, when my dad called me, that was sort of a problem, and my solution to that was, okay, you get the teacher certificate, but you take as much other higher math as you can this year, during your college years. And so that's what I did. And I believe having thought that through before I got to college actually pushed me to sign up for these other classes. And my senior year, both semesters, I did student teaching and took four higher math classes.
So that decision. That decision to get the certificate but take a lot of math on the side was probably one of your first most brilliant calculations that you made.
Well, it was, and I think it allowed a lot of other things to happen.
Yeah. Well, and you mentioned this. You did go to, for graduate work, what is now Hampton University, right? A historically black college university.
For my undergraduate, I went to Hampton University.
Undergrad. How important was that to go to a historically black college? For you, do you think?
I believe sometimes we got more support in the historically black colleges. And Virginia State was also historically black. And the head of that math department, he was he would talk about things we should be doing during class. He would meet me on the sidewalk and give me advice about doing this. He would say, where have you been? I want you to take that class over there. Go over there and talk to Mr. So-and-so and see if you can sign up. So he was right in there giving me advice about how to do things also.
You were hired as what has come to be known as a human computer at NASA in 1967. Talk about that hire and your first work, the work you did initially at NASA.
Okay, I was hired as a human computer. I didn't know what I was being hired as when I went there. But I was assigned to the reentry physics branch, They didn't have the segregated computers by the time I got there. The segregation, which was in the movie and the book, changed when NACA became NASA, and that was right after Sputnik went up in 1957, and they created NASA in 1958 from the old NACA. And so there was no more segregation after that. And so I was assigned to the reentry physics branch, which worked on creating the speed and the angle at which a space vehicle would come back into Earth's atmosphere safely so that it would not get so hot that the vehicle burned up, or it would come in at an angle at which it would bounce off of the atmosphere rather than come smoothly into the atmosphere.
Now, you were not particularly interested in this work, and you asked to be changed. You asked to get a different job. Talk about that, please.
Okay. Well, yeah, most of those calculations for the Apollo program had been done before I got there. And so I worked in that area for about 5 years, and the engineers would bring over equations, and I would write a program to solve their equations and things like that. And so the work was okay, but I realized that the equations they were working with were very similar to the equations I had worked on in graduate school. And I wondered why, you know, the engineers were doing all of that, and I had come there with that background, and yet they were doing this, and I was supporting them. And so I asked about transferring to engineering by my supervisor, and they said no, they didn't think that was possible. And so I thought for another couple of weeks or so, and then I decided I was going to go and talk to a higher level director and ask that question, because I had decided I would rather go back to teaching than to spend my entire career doing what I was doing. And so I went to a director who was two or three levels up and I said, I'd like to ask a question. Why is it that a male and a female coming here with identical backgrounds are assigned to such different positions? The male is put into an engineering section where he does his own research. He gives talks, he writes papers, and he gets promoted. The females are pretty much put into the computer pool where they support the engineer. They don't give talks, they don't write papers, and they usually don't even get their name on a paper. And getting a name on a paper or writing a paper was a big effort in getting promoted at NASA. And so a lot of the females didn't get promoted either. And he looked at me and he said, well, nobody's ever asked that question before. And I said, well, I'm asking it now. And we talked a little bit after that, but then I left and went back to my office. And in a couple of weeks, I was promoted and I was transferred to an engineering section. So it was a risk I took, and I knew I could have been fired for doing it, but it paid off. And I was assigned to an engineering area, which ended up being in the supersonic area, working on the sonic boom.
I do want to talk more about that, but I just want to remind everybody that I'm talking to retired NASA aerospace engineer Christine Darden today on the State of Things. Do tell us more about the work that you were doing quite a bit of that work.
So it was 1972 when I got that promotion and was transferred, and the United States, the first supersonic flight had occurred in 1947. During the 60s and late 60s, the United States, the Russians, and the English and the French had all decided they were going to build a supersonic transport. And, of course, this is an airplane that flies faster than the speed of sound. And they were talking about building a commercial airplane like, you know, United or American and so forth. And they, as part of United States preparation to do this, they did two big flight tests using military supersonic vehicles flying over Chicago and Oklahoma City. And so they had all these supersonic airplanes flying over these huge cities. Well, they got calls. They got probably thousands of calls, and they had folks answering the phones with people complaining about their cracked sheetrock or their cracked windows or their cracked China and things like that, they got so many complaints that the United States canceled its SST program. We weren't even allowed to use the word SST. And they not only did they cancel the program, the United States voted a law that there could be no commercial supersonic flight over the continental United States. And it apparently that moved sort of around the world.
So the nut you've got to crack is figure out, because there's a lot of money to be made if you can fly at that speed, but it's noisy. How do you fly at that speed and reduce the noise? And that's your job, right?
Yeah, so that's what NASA had done. They had created this section that was going to work on trying to minimize the sonic boom. And so my first job was I was handed a technical report by two professors from Cornell who had this idea based on some earlier work that that the equivalent area distribution of the airplane was a big factor in that. And so the program that I was to write was to solve this system of equations that based on the altitude, the weight, the length, and the speed of the airplane, it would define what this equivalent area distribution was. The equivalent area distribution would be pretty much the cross-sectional area of the airplane, all the way from the nose of the airplane to the tail of the airplane.
Sounds like an easy problem to describe in words, but how long did it take and how close did you get to solving the problem?
Okay, well, once I got the code to run, we it took several months because we were doing this by hand. We would design an airplane, and then we would calculate that area, and we would compare it to our target, and we would have to go back and decide where we needed to change the design. And so that was an iterative process, and it took, I can't remember exactly, probably, 4 or 5 months.
Amazing stuff.
For us to do that. And once we were pretty much on the target equivalent area distribution, we had that model built out of stainless steel. The model was about 7 inches long, and it cost $6,000 or $7,000. And once we got that model, and we would also always build the shape of a military supersonic airplane, like a Delta wing or something, because those military airplanes would give a shock. They called an end wave, which would be a loud boom, and then it would go down, and then maybe a boom at the tail, depending on how long the airplane was. And so we would always want to test the baseline along with our designs. And so we got these steel models, and we put them in our supersonic wind tunnel, which was 4 feet by 4 feet, square in shape. And we would blow the air past the airplane itself. So if our test speed was Mach 2, and Mach is a man's name who discovered how important the speed of sound was in the study of fluids. And so Mach 1 is the speed of sound. Mach 2 is twice the speed of sound. And the speed of sound at sea level is 750 miles an hour. And so we would blow the air past the airplane at that speed, and we would have pressure probes inside the wind tunnel measuring the pressures coming off of that airplane. And it ends up that when the airplane is going supersonically, all of the disturbances generated by that airplane are inside of a cone, like a backwards cone on the nose of the airplane. And so the pressure inside that cone is actually higher than the pressure outside of that cone, because all of the molecules that get pushed out of the way are inside that cone.
And it's that movement that makes the noise, that displacement.
Yes, and so there were shocks off of different elements of the airplane itself. And so we would get the pressure inside that cone and the pressure outside that cone. And the difference in those two pressures is really the sonic boom.
Wow. It's amazing stuff. And what this does, too, of course, this combines your mathematics with engineering, because you're also having to design the test.
Oh, absolutely.
Fascinating.
And
stuff.
That's why I got my master's degree from Virginia State in applied mathematics. So the applied mathematics and the theoretical engineering are really pretty close together.
Fascinating story. Christine Darden, retired NASA aerospace engineer and mathematician, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.